Hi, everybody. This is Micha Sifri with Personal Diplomacy Forum. Welcome you to another in the ongoing series of PDF Network conference calls that we do with movers and shakers and innovators in the political technology arena. As always, we are most appreciative to our sponsors at AT&T and the Vivings Group, whose ongoing support makes these calls possible. Today, I'm very excited to be welcoming Kate Albright-Hanna, who was the director of online video for the Obama campaign in 2008, who's going to be joining us for the hour to talk about how you can use online video to grow your campaign. And let me just say that I think it's a real treat to have Kate. I really appreciate her taking the time to talk with us. She's no longer directly working in politics, and she comes from a background in journalism and has gone back into journalism, into documentary journalism, though I think, as you'll hear, a lot of what Kate has learned and continues to practice as a documentarian was part of the secret sauce in what the Obama campaign learned to do with video. And what the way this call is going to go, as always, for the first half hour, we'll ask you to just mute your phones and listen in and not interrupt. But if you have a question, use the chat. We're also using the Twitter hashtag of PDF Network, so feel free to Twitter away about the conversation there. For the first half hour, I will sort of walk Kate through some of the history and practice of the campaign and the lessons learned, and then in the second half, we'll open it up to your questions. So, Kate, why don't you take the first couple of minutes and just sort of give us, you know, we know the big picture, right? We know that the Obama campaign did an extraordinary amount with video online, well over 1,000 individual YouTube videos made. I think the number was about 120 million individual views of those videos, which we once calculated was worth at least $40 or $50 million if you tried to convert that into 30-second TV ad viewership. Some of those videos enormously viral online, Obama's speech on race getting still going, but it's well over 6 million individual views of a 37-minute long video, not exactly the sort of thing most people think millions of people will take the time to watch. But there was a lot going on under the surface, and what I'm wondering is whether you can take us through a bit of the history, how you got involved in the campaign from the beginning, and also, you know, what you confronted thinking about how to use video. You know, take us back to early 2007, where up to that point, I guess, you know, the major, if you Googled the terms YouTube in politics, the major thing that would come up would be George Allen's macaca moment. Most people thought of online video as a threat to a campaign as opposed to, something that could help propel a candidate's message and help build a movement. So with that as an introduction, I'd like to, you know, let you sort of give us the story as you saw it unfold, and I'll try not to interrupt until halfway through the half hour.
Okay. Well, I'd actually like to go all the way back to 2003. I was at CNN, and I was doing a documentary on the Dean campaign. And, there was something that was happening in that campaign that was different from all the other campaigns, and I wanted to document that. And I thought one thing that was really important is that the campaign manager, Joe Trippi, would always say, you know, the other candidates say, look at me, aren't I special? We say, look at you, aren't you special? And I think that the narrative of that campaign about people power, about putting the focus back on the voters, about reinvigorating democracy, about a grassroots movement, and the technology allowing that message to have some real effect was what was inspiring about that campaign and interesting to me as a journalist. So in 2007, I wanted to continue to follow that story. So one of the bloggers from the Dean campaign, Joe Rosebars, had become the director of new media for the Obama campaign. And I approached him and I asked him if I could do a documentary about the Obama campaign. You know, at the same time, I was also feeling a little frustrated about mainstream media, the way that we were covering politics. You know, people's stories seemed to be boring. It was all about the horse race. And, you know, the focus was on the candidates, of course. But it wasn't about what was really happening out in the country. So I told him, you know, that's what I wanted to focus on. And he said, well, you can't do a documentary. You can't embed yourself into a documentary about the campaign, but you can actually join our campaign and tell people stories. So that's what I did. I joined the campaign, and, you know, there was a lot of conventional wisdom around video at the time, especially campaign video. But, again, I was still influenced by Joe Trippi's idea from the Dean campaign that, you know, we're not selling a candidate like a product. We're engaging people in a dialogue, and that's the innovation. So it was really important to me not to, you know, drag an intern out in front of our building and say, you know, say something about, you know, how people deserve equal rights. You know, instead, we, you know, we would send out an email asking for people's stories. People would tell us their story. You know, just as an example, there was one guy in Mississippi who had lived on this plantation that his family had owned for centuries and had owned slaves. And, you know, I went out to visit him there, and, you know, he planted his Obama sign in his yard and talked about the significance of that for him and for, you know, the generations of, you know, the families that had lived on that plantation. So I think, you know, even if we only used one soundbite from that interview, you know, we had had an actual dialogue, and I think that authenticity came through in our videos, that we were actually spending time with people. So, you know, another kind of hang-up I would say that people had at the time was that videos needed to be viral. They needed to be short and funny, and you needed to get people's attention. But I would say, like, well, you know, if we filmed Barack falling down the stairs, that would instantly go viral. And what does that do for us? And what does that do for the process? So, again, we didn't measure our success by how many hits we were getting, and I think that allowed us to stay true to our mission, which was to engage people in this dialogue. And, you know, there was that Macaca video where it could show that there could be gotcha moments that could be used in the campaigns, that YouTube could be a force for evil, but we were determined to make it a force for good, which meant really having more in-depth conversations with people. So, again, we didn't measure our success by numbers, but we measured it by the quality of the conversation that was happening in reaction to our videos. And we would read those comments, and we would be inspired, or we took direction from them often. And it would influence our whole new media operation as well. So, for example, although most of our videos were focused on, you know, people's stories, we did do a sort of behind-the-scenes documentary of the Obamas at the convention in Denver, where we followed them around and really got sort of authentic moments with them where they finally forgot that the cameras were around and they could just be themselves. And we called it 4 Days in Denver. And one of the comments in the comment section was that, you know, when people ask me who the real Barack Obama is, because at that time the other side was, you know, spreading a lot of who is the real Barack Obama nonsense. You know, he said, when I get one of those emails forwarded to me from a relative or a friend, you know, about Barack Obama, I say, this is the real Barack Obama. So we, from that comment, decided to send out an email to our 13 million person list saying who was the real Barack Obama that linked to that video, and people got insight into that. So, you know, I think that people felt that we were listening to them, and we were. And I would say that that was the main innovation of how we used video in the campaign.
Mm-hmm. Can you take us back to the beginning, though? I mean, if we're, you know, what you're describing is a strategic approach that evolved, right, as opposed to you knew right away this was the way to go. I mean, what, you know, how did the campaign learn to trust that this approach worked?
Yeah, I mean, in the beginning there was pressure, you know, there's a sort of a conventional thing to do in video, especially in political video, which is to ask people to make an ad for the campaign, you know, as a way to get user-generated stuff. And we could have done that early in the campaign, but we thought, you know, the whole point is that we're not trying to sell the candidate like a product. We are trying to engage a dialogue. And so if we ask people to become marketers, then that's against our message. So, you know, even doing that might have actually inspired a lot of creative content, but we ruled it out because it wasn't on our message. So I think that, you know, we had to make a lot of calls every step of the way, but we, having sort of a value system in place, allowed us to choose what we were going to do and what we weren't going to do and how we were going to approach certain things. So, yeah, I mean, we would say that the campaign was like building an airplane in midair, and it definitely felt that way. And, you know, we did enough videos that some of them, you know, weren't as successful. I mean, I guess, for example, like a good example would be in the beginning, we did the YouTube spotlight video, and, you know, I had this vision of, you know, I would be walking around with Barack Obama, and he would be, you know, in the car and saying things off the cuff, and, you know, it would be all on a digital, you know, a handheld camera. But I realized that I was going up against sort of a campaign system where they're used to just normal sit-down interviews. So I'm embarrassed by the production quality of that particular thing because I was prepared to shoot it verite style, and it just looks bad. So I guess that would be an early mistake. Understanding that we needed to put videos in different categories. If you're going to do a direct-to-camera video with the candidate, you know, you need to make it look good and you need to set it up with proper lighting. But if you're doing something that is more, you know, in the moment like we did in the convention, then that's more appropriate. So I would say that there were certain stylistic things that we had to work out, and, you know, all of our stuff does not look pretty. But, again, we had sort of a value system that was leading us along the way, and I don't think that changed much over the course of the campaign.
Mm-hmm. Talk a bit about how you evolved the use of video as a tool to assist field organizing. Because one of the things I think that people may not realize, and, you know, these videos don't get the, you know, millions or hundreds of thousands of views that, you know, you'll see if you sort of scroll through the campaign's list. But there were dozens and dozens of videos that had a very local flavor and focus, you know, ranging from people in North Carolina in a African-American barbershop, you know, talking about their feelings about the campaign in advance of the North Carolina primary, to videos with Michelle Obama, you know, aimed at, I think this was for Hawaii, if I'm not mistaken, you know, in eight different Pacific Islander languages. So, I mean, really there was an integration here with field that was very important to the strategy of building the base so you could get as big a vote as possible.
Right. That was actually Maya, Barack's sister, who did all the Pacific Islander ones. Because, you know, that's a natural constituency, and she and her husband, Conrad, were amazing in reaching out to that community. So, yeah, we had lots of different clients on the campaign. You know, we would have the Veterans for Obama guy coming over and asking for something specific. We had First Americans for Obama, where we actually flew somebody out to a reservation in New Mexico and spent time with them, interviewing them, and did a whole video that, you know, went into their issues and their specific needs. So there was a lot of targeting going on specifically for different groups, as well as for issues. We also did a series called Blueprint for America that went, you know, issue by issue in terms of healthcare and, you know, foreign policy, and got into the details of that. So there was also just purely motivational videos for people who were in specific. So, you know, we did a video for Iowa, which, you know, even if it for the Iowa steak fry, that really captured the experience of the people on the ground and the volunteers who, you know, prepared for the steak fry and then participated in the parade and everything that happened around that event. And even though it doesn't have as many views as some of the other videos, it was probably one of the most important because it really cheered people up who were there in Iowa and motivated people on the ground, and they were able to see what they were building there. So something that was targeted at a specific group of people, especially volunteers and super volunteers, might have more of an impact for the campaign than something that had mass appeal for people all over America.
To what extent were you tracking the metrics on, you know, who was watching what videos? Like, everybody knows the Obama campaign was very data-oriented, so I'm curious to what degree the video team was also expected to sort of justify the impact of particular videos or, you know, studied their spread to particular demographics or geographic. There's a lot of data you can get your hands on. So to what degree were you listening to what that told you?
I mean, honestly, we really were more concerned with the reaction of people in the comment section and what people were saying than we were with the numbers. You know, it's kind of part of our philosophy of not being ratings driven. So it is interesting that in other aspects of the new media department, you know, we had analytics guys from Google who were crunching numbers. And they would, I should say that they would test different videos and different emails to see, you know, what was more effective in an email. And they found that sometimes a video was incredibly effective in an email for raising money, and sometimes it was actually a distraction that, it, you know, somebody would start watching a video and they would forget to donate. So that was an interesting finding, that it wasn't always best, even if everybody's opening up the email and clicking on the video, if that's not what we needed at that moment, then they would learn from that and not do it again. But sometimes we did need people to watch our videos if there was a message that we needed to get out there, or if there was, you know, just a moment in time where, you know, people needed to be all on the same page about where the campaign was headed and what they needed to do to make the campaign successful, then they would include the video. So I would say that that's where all of our analytic focus went into, which was, you know, when to put it into an email and when not to.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, sort of platforms? Everybody talks about YouTube. Were there other video platforms that you guys used that, you know, didn't get as much attention but turned out to be valuable? And what do you think a campaign should do? Should it put all of its eggs on the YouTube basket or spread them around?
Well, in the beginning, we had Barack TV, which was a Bright Cove player that was on our website. And We later figured out that was really stupid, that we should have been using YouTube from the beginning, that, you know, that was the way that videos got watched and spread around a lot faster and more efficiently than, you know, bringing somebody to our site and getting them to watch the video on the site. In the end, we used Barack TV as sort of a curated gallery of our favorite videos so that people could have that experience when they came to the website and wanted to know more about the campaign. But, yeah, you know, again, this was 2007 to 2008. I'm sure that, you know, other services are already rising up and, you know, are going to be as important as YouTube, but at the time that was the major player. So, you know, unlike a company, we didn't need people to come and visit our website specifically. We needed people to vote for Barack Obama. So getting our message out was more important than having people visit our website. So, yeah, definitely putting it on as many other platforms as possible is great. You know, we would also put things on to Black Planet and, you know, different constituency groups that had, people gathered. We would also reach out to those, but I would say YouTube was the most important for us.
Right. Do you know offhand what the metrics were of, you know, say, I mean, I don't know what a typical video would be, but what percentage of the views came from people watching it on the campaign website, on BarackObama.com somewhere, or from people watching it elsewhere where it was embedded on someone else's site? Any sense of, you know, how much was site-centric, how much was dispersed?
I don't remember the numbers, but I know that we looked at that and we decided that our site was ridiculously insignificant compared to people posting them outside and sharing them. I mean, the most powerful tool we had was email. That's the way you delivered it straight to people. So if we put a video in an email, then we know it was going to be huge. So that was our the biggest weapon in our arsenal, I would say. Video on site was one of the smaller tools.
Huh. Talk a bit about how the campaign decided to relate to user-generated videos. I mean, there were a couple of episodes over the course that, obviously stand out. There's the Phil DeVelice, Vote Different video, which was controversial early along. There was the Yes We Can song, right, from Will.i.am. What was the thinking inside the campaign about how to relate to all of this voter-generated content? And, you know, who was the smart person who said, just let it be, you know, we're not going to sue people for using our logo, our likeness, our film without our permission?
Well, I think, you know, the first thing anybody who came into our campaign and wanted to work on video would ask is, how are we going to do user-generated video? And I asked the same question, you know, that's the frontier. How are we going to do that? But I think it's one of the tensions of the top-down, bottom-up dynamic of how do you engage user-generated content in a campaign where if you make a big mistake or offend somebody, then you could put the entire campaign in danger. So we decided that we needed to we treated people who wanted to volunteer in video as just that. It's like we needed to get the volunteer into our system. They needed to understand what our bigger message was. They became part of the team. If somebody wanted to submit a video, then they became a volunteer. If somebody did a video outside of the campaign, first of all, there are campaign finance rules that you can't spend a certain amount of money and donate it to the campaign. So in the case of high production value or music, you know, a lot of that time we just even weren't allowed to touch it because it would have been a violation of campaign finance law. So, you know, we definitely did have a firewall between what was happening out there and what was kind of officially within our world of official campaign video and contribution. So we would try to do user-generated activities like a video we did, Signs of Hope and Change. We emailed our list of people and broke it down by people who had creative backgrounds, especially photographers, and asked for people to hold signs that said hope and change and gave them very specific instructions about, you know, what size it should be and how they should hold the sign. So we would give people very specific assignments and have them submit it, and it became part of a larger video. But if we were to just say, hey, you know, just send in your video and we'll put it up, well, you have to be able to vet the music and a lot of other things. So that we just didn't have the resources to do all the vetting unless the person, you know, was really part of our team. So if that answers your question, there was, definitely a lot of crazy things happening outside of the official campaign, and we enjoyed the creativity that people had for the most part outside of the campaign, and we hope that we set a tone with our own videos that inspired artists to do their own thing as well. We hope that we set a tone of authenticity, of respect for creativity, that would allow other people to feel like they could create art and it didn't feel like propaganda. It felt like something that was coming from the heart. So I think that we found that balance. I'm really impressed by all the stuff that happened.
Sure. And I mean, but in the case of the Yes We Can video by Will.i.am, the campaign embraced that one big time, right? I mean, there was clearly, you sent around at least one, if not many, emails telling people to go watch it.
Yeah, definitely.
Right.
And I believe they even played it at some Obama events as well.
Mm-hmm.
But we were not involved in the production in any way of that video.
Right. Right. Yeah, no, that's clear. Well, we're coming up on the half-hour mark, so I'm going to throw the lines open, as they say. If people who are listening want to unmute and ask a question, this usually works fine without needing to cue people up, so just unmute your phone, say your name, and you know, hopefully a brief question for Kate Albright-Hanna. If no one has a question, of course I can keep going. We give them a
Hi, Kate. It's Arjun Singh here. Thanks for your really great presentation thus far. If you could really kind of bootstrap the technology, like the kind of hardware and software you'd use, like, you know, what's sort of the lowest level of entry you can get into doing good online video, do you think? Maybe that's a tough question, but I wanted to ask it.
Like, what's the minimum amount of equipment that you need to do online video?
Yeah, I mean, not a lot of money, not a lot of ability to get hardware and software organized, but, you know, want to do a good job kind of thing.
Well, I think the most important thing is sound. And it's kind of unappreciated for people who are just getting into video. So I think the minimum requirement is to have a camera that has a microphone that is on board and for it to be able to plug into a mult box. So if you need to record a speech or an official event, that's usually helpful if you have a campaign or a nonprofit. So I think, you know, that camera plus microphone plus computer with Final Cut software on it comes out to approximately around $8,000, I would say, off the top of my head, for kind of the basic package of, you know, getting pretty good sound and good video. Of course, it's possible to just go out with a little flip cam for $400 and use your iMac and put it up, and it's, you know, a few hundred dollars. So it just depends on what your goals are and what your level of, what your standards are, I guess.
When you say $8,000, what can you be more specific of the type of hardware you would recommend somebody getting if they have that budget?
Oh, it's hard to, I mean, new cameras are coming out all the time, so it depends on if you need HD or if you are good with just digital. You know, the cameras that we used in the campaign were PD150s, Sony, and I think they were about $3,000, but that was in 2007. And, you know, Final Cut software, I'm trying to remember, I think it was like around $1,500. So, I mean, it really, there's just so many options out there, and it really depends on what you need and what you're shooting.
Mm-hmm. Another question from the Peanut Gallery.
Actually, I have a question.
Okay,
and,
please identify.
Can everyone hear me?
Sorry, please identify yourself.
Sure. My name is Isaiah Poole. I'm the editor of OurFuture.org. We've done a number of videos, and a lot of what we do is using video to try to explain an issue or to explain a position that we've taken on an issue. which is difficult because, you know, we're doing stuff that 99% of the time doesn't allow for the kind of viral kind of, the kinds of things that normally click with that make people watch a YouTube video. It's not funny. It doesn't have a gimmick. Two questions. Number one, what works in terms of an issue-oriented video? Number two, when you say that email is an effective medium for pushing video, what's the best way to do that, and what works best?
In terms of issue-oriented videos, I found that if we needed to explain something complicated in a short amount of time, I went to the motion graphics guys and found a great piece of music and let the cartoon guys take it from there. That was just the easiest, punchiest way to do something that would get a point across. You could have somebody sit in front of a camera and explain it, but that's really boring. Our motion graphics guys who, you know, believed in the cause and were working at a third of their normal rate were the source of a lot of our most amazing pieces because it was a way to communicate in a fun and easy way, and they were just really creative about it. In terms of how do you use email, what do you mean by that, like, how do you embed the video, or
well, number one, do you embed the video or link to it?
We link to it.
Okay. And yeah, I assume that you would have some sort of graphic that would entice people to click.
Trying to think. I think it just said like click here for video, and maybe it was bold, maybe it was blue. I'm trying to remember, but. I think when people saw video in the subject line, I think I remember our analytics guy saying that the open rate was higher. Mm-hmm. So people knew that they were getting something out of it, that it wasn't just another, like, appeal for money.
Mm-hmm. But in general, what you're telling us is that a video of sort of a serious person sitting at a desk talking is not going to convey, it's just not going to get watched by many people because it's visually not interesting.
Exactly.
We're going back to the visual quality of video being the key element here.
I mean, the most important thing is to be able to tell a story. And so, you know, we had to, near the election, there was the danger that, you know, voters would not come out because the Republicans were warning of voter fraud, and so we did a video called The Myth of Voter Fraud, and, you know, it had to take people through a short history and explain, you know, how they could recognize intimidation, and so there were a lot of kind of informational pieces we had to get in there, and I think we were able to do it by framing the whole issue within a story. You know, so we opened up on a large crowd of people at a rally, and we really framed it in the context of, like, this is your movement, this is your government, this is your democracy, don't let them take your right to vote away from you. So once you hook people with the idea of, like, oh, there's something at stake here, then they're more willing to listen. So a lot of it is just, if you're not going to go with the 30-second cartoon guy, you can also go with the powerful story arc. This is what's really at stake. Because once people realize there's a bad guy and a good guy and that, you know, there is sort of a climax to the story and an ending and a, like, okay, what do I need to do now, a call to action at the end of it, then people will sit and watch the whole video and they'll get the information out of it, especially if you are able to tell that story in an interesting way. So for that story, we interviewed people in our campaign who were on the front lines of, you know, looking into voter intimidation and what they were seeing out there and what they were concerned about. And, you know, we broke it up into terms of chapters, and we kind of gave it a style like the worst-case survival guide. So as opposed to just having a boring guy, you know, directly look at the camera and try to read a script. Oh, that was the worst, by the way. Before we got teleprompters, trying to get people to memorize something and say it straight to the camera was the biggest disaster. Like, it was, because these aren't professional actors, usually. And even when we had professional actors, that didn't always work out very well either. So it was better to interview somebody and then make it part of a story. And I guess maybe that's my prejudice coming from more of a journalism background, but I just found that that's how people are used to consuming their content when it's presented to them like a story as opposed to this is spinach, you need to sit and take in this information from somebody just talking at you. Am I rambling?
No. Isaiah, does that answer your question?
It's very helpful. In fact, I come from a journalism background as well, so I totally appreciate what you're saying.
Cool. Other questions from people listening in on the call? Just please unmute, tell us your name, and try to keep the question fairly short if you can. Okay, Kate, I have a question, which is, did you guys worry about what any of the other campaigns were doing? Did you spend any time watching what the other campaigns were doing with video and trying to figure out if there was something you should copy or respond to? What was the relationship there?
Well, I remember one of McCain's viral videos. They did a takeoff of Pimp My Ride, which was a show on MTV. And they gave people a tour of the Straight Talk Express and showed how pimp it was and, like, how blinged out it was. And it was actually, like, really high production values and really fun to watch. And I was kind of concerned when I first watched it, like, whoa, they're, like, serious over there. They're doing, like, good videos. But then we realized, is that really on message? This is where your money is going, your $5, your, you know, whatever you are giving to the campaign, it's going to pay for this really expensive bus. So, you know, I think that sometimes, again, that came into, like, what is your message versus trying to get a lot of people to watch your video? And at the end of the day, what is your measure of success? So, and then, you know, Hillary Clinton did a series on her website called The Hillary I Know, which, again, were, like, really well-shot interviews with people talking about how they knew Hillary Clinton personally. And I think that tied into her message at the time, which was, you know, getting people to know a more personal side of Hillary. But, again, that would have been off message on our side because we weren't about the candidate. We were about the movement. So, you know, we were interested in what the other campaigns were doing, but I don't think we were concerned about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, mm-hmm. if you looked at Clinton's YouTube page, most of the videos were her campaign ads. So they weren't doing a lot of original, more grassroots-y videos. And we had our campaign ads up on our page as well, but they were mixed in with, you know, stuff that was coming in from Colorado and Pennsylvania and everywhere we had volunteers on the ground making videos about regular supporters.
Sure, sure. Well, that actually brings up another point I wanted to ask you about. And this is something that in some of the books and meetings that have been held, you know, since the election ended, some of the people on the campaign communication side from both Obama and McCain have talked about the way that they deliberately built a system for generating web-only political videos that were designed to more or less distract the political press corps. And just sort of give them something to chew on, but not necessarily, you know, that these things were like web-only distractions, and they never spent money to put them, you know, before voters in any significant way, and that you, in effect, use some portion of your online video to just play tit-for-tat and give, you know, the cable chat shows something to argue over while, you know, you're doing what you actually want to do on the ground. And was that something you were involved in or you saw? I mean, you know, to what degree is this like a new feature of the 24-hour news cycle of just throwing little attack ads up on the web that you never really spend money on?
When we went into the general, we created a rapid response team. So we definitely had a guy who was just devoted to doing longer form pieces and more movement-based documentary style pieces. And then I had my, I don't know if I should say, I called him my dark star, this kid who would do rapid response videos, which were, again, more directed at responding to the incoming that we had that day. At the time, I don't think we thought of it as a distraction for people, but we definitely had that tool in our arsenal, I keep saying that, which was, we had a team that was dedicated to pushing back. And so the biggest pushback piece we did was something called Keating Economics, which was, probably the piece that we worked the closest with our communications department with. It was a 20-minute documentary with where we interviewed Bill Black, who talked about the Keating Five scandal, and we had to, really explain it to people who had either forgotten or didn't know much about it. We coordinated the launch of that on our website and shared it with the press. And so I think that was probably our most successful effort in terms of being able to do something that I felt had journalistic integrity. There wasn't anything that was over the top or untrue about it, and I think it educated people, and it was able at the time to change the conversation. I'm trying to remember what was happening. I don't know if it was the Bill Ayers thing, or the McCain campaign was coming at the Obama campaign with their own negative onslaught, and we needed to talk about what had happened with Keating Five. So that was an example of, pushing back on the news of the day, using an internet launch to get into the news. So, that was, I guess the point is that department had a different audience than the rest of our videos, where the rest of our videos was really about maintaining the connection with our supporters and keeping that dialogue open, because no campaign had ever really had that direct communication with supporters. Traditionally campaigns have had the audience of reporters and the audience of sort of the masses, where you put up a campaign ad and you try to convince lots of people who are undecided. Nobody had ever talked directly to the supporters. So I would say our rapid response department was continuing the, just using the internet, but continuing the old tradition of communicating with reporters.
Very interesting. Other questions from the audience listening?
Yes, hi. This is Megan Tatey from the organization Free Press, and we've been using a lot of comedy in our videos recently, and I'm wondering how you all used humor with the Obama campaign and if it worked for you.
Comedy's hard.
Yeah, it is.
I think that... we tried to use comedy. I think we had one video that was directed and produced by our media director, our new media director, Joe Rosebarts. He loves the blog fail.org. Is that what it is? The fail blog?
Yeah.
So there is a fail where a guy is, riding his bicycle, and he's almost about to win. He starts celebrating. He throws his hands up in the air, and then the bicycle goes out of control, and he falls down, and everybody else crosses the finish line before he does. And, this was right when everything was looking really good for us in the last days before the election, and people were feeling really confident. Our supporters were. We weren't feeling as confident inside campaign headquarters, and we needed to communicate to everybody that it's not time to celebrate yet. You're going to drop the ball, because we all need to stay worried and we need to stay focused and we need to do everything we can to cross this finish line. So our motion graphics guys were able to put McCain's head and Barack's head, like a little jib-jabby style, on top of these bicycle guys. And, it was like a 30-second piece, and it was great. People liked it. They usually laugh. So, yeah, if you can, like, do comedy, it's just that sometimes if you fail, it's embarrassing. So,
I have to tell you, if I remember hearing Joe talk about that episode, the campaign was actually seeing the open rates on emails were dropping, and the number of people who were signing up for phone banking and volunteering in the last few days before the election, they actually saw a real drop in those metrics. And so the worry was that people were like, okay, we're going to win so we can relax.
Right.
And, you know, so it's very, very interesting. And it's a good reminder that what the new media team does in the final days of an election can be extraordinarily critical and not to rest on your laurels. Other questions from people on the call? Okay. Well, interrupt me if you're just unmuting. But it's okay. Looking forward, what would you say are the big lessons learned? And, you know, I assume you're watching other campaigns that have played out over the last year that are also making use of video. I mean, we've had several gubernatorial races, and we're heading into a midterm congressional battle. Do you see people copying what the Obama campaign did effectively? Do you see people innovating? That, you know, anything that's really struck you in the last year?
Yeah, I rode on the Tea Party Express from Mississippi to Louisiana, and I was surprised by how well they've learned the lessons of the Obama campaign. They had an onboard video operation, and, you know, they were telling me that, you know, the most important thing is telling people stories. And I said, really? Oh, my gosh. So they're out there, and, you know, they are building a true grassroots movement by actually listening to people and reflecting back their stories through video. And, you know, I think that it just goes to show that no matter what your, you know, what side of the partisan line you're on, it's really an approach that will either build the momentum and build the movement. So even if your message is, you know, anti-government, anti-raising taxes, shutting down healthcare, you can still build the grassroots movement by, you know, talking to normal people and, you know, putting their videos up online, telling their stories in the blog. So I think this reaches across, you know, I don't think that the left has this part nailed down and the right hasn't figured it out. I think the Tea Party movement is figuring it out.
Very interesting. There's a question in the chat from Peg Byron, which I'm going to read. How quickly could you put together response videos like the Keating Economics video or the bike fail animation piece that you just described?
Those days are such a blur to me, but I know that we were doing things that would be impossible in real life. We put together Heating Economics in like 3 days, and it's like a real documentary. The bicycle piece we did probably in 5 hours. But it was like we were all in some kind of crazed, otherworldly mindset at the time where, you know, nothing was more important than changing the world. So, you know, we had a staff of people who worked every day of the week, all day and night. You know, people, there was somebody in the office 24 hours a day just working on videos. And so if it had to get done, we got it done by the time we needed to get it done, and things always had to be immediate or you would lose the moment in the news cycle or in the zeitgeist or whatever was happening in the country.
Can I ask you about one of my favorites, which is the video of Obama a day or two after Hillary Clinton formally withdrew, and it's the staff meeting, and it looks like a pretty impromptu moment. I mean, clearly there were videos set up because you captured him from a couple of angles, but, you know, he walks onto the floor of, I guess, you know, HQ in Chicago, one of the your big office settings, and there are a couple hundred people, and they start applauding, and then he talks in a very extemporaneous way about what this incredibly young and dedicated group of volunteers and staff have just accomplished. Was there a big, you know, like, let's make sure we capture this moment decision? Was it just luck that you captured it? Is there a reason? I mean, there were a few times where the campaign seemed to really pull back the curtain and, you know, sort of try to give an unvarnished view right into the center of what was going on. So I'm wondering if you can, you know, replay that moment and the thinking around it and, you know, to get to fight somebody, to get permission to do that, or, you know, what was, because it's so unusual.
Yeah, there were a lot of times in the beginning of the campaign where Barack would walk through our office and we wouldn't have a camera and I would just, like, want to die because, like, something amazing would happen. He would have a conversation with somebody and I was like, ah, that would have been a great moment. There was one time when he came into our new media area and everybody was, like, entering data and doing what they did, and he said, hey, guys. And I think people had just, like, gotten so used to hearing his voice in the videos or whatever that nobody even looked around. He had to say, hey, guys, and we all, oh, hey, how's it going? Yeah, at a certain point, I mandated that everybody on the video team have a camera on their desk with a tape loaded and batteries full so that they could pick it up and just shoot whatever was happening in the office, because we would have, you know, really interesting people come through as well. And so that day was one of those days where, you know, we heard he was in the office, and I ran over, and I said, can I put a wireless mic on him? And they said, okay. And, you know, he looked at me, and he's like, do I really have to do this? I'm like, yes, please. So, you know, we were, and then I ordered my other two video guys who were, you know, sitting on the floor there to shoot from their position on the floor. There was no thought that went into this production. So it really was authentically as thrown together as it looked.
And it turned out to be pretty successful as well, right?
Yeah, people really enjoyed that, watching it online, you know, to get a little insight into what it was like in the office and, you know, what it's like when he is just speaking, you know, off the cuff from his heart,
right,
and talking to the people who are working for him. So I think that's a no-brainer. Like,
right. But you said when you tried to get that, I mean, I don't think I'm spilling any beans here, but you've told me that when you tried to get him to be off the cuff in a planned way, that it was very, very hard to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's true in campaigns and probably in nonprofits as well, is that there's kind of a mentality of we've got a message and we need to deliver our message. And even as somebody who is, you know, from the campaign, it's a completely safe environment. There's not going to be a macaca moment because I work for you. That there's still this mentality of we need to stay on message. So there were a lot of times when the journalist in me would try to, like, knock him off script so that he would say something that was revealing, say something that he hadn't said a million times before and was just sort of saying it like a robot. And I think there was a few times that we were able to do that. You know, there was one day when he was touring a steel factory that had closed in Chicago, and I took him aside to ask him some questions about community organizing for a video we were doing. And I think I was able to ask him some questions that he hadn't heard before, and I think his answers were a lot more interesting than most of them, because he wasn't used to saying them, you know, every single day, several times a day. So, yeah, there was definitely tension within, you know, a large organization to convince people that the off-the-cuff stuff and the unguarded moments is actually what's going to connect with people, and it's going to go a lot further with people than saying the same message over and over again and pounding people over the head with that. But, you know, everybody has a different role to play in the campaign, and, you know, if your role is to keep things safe and keep risk low, then you're not going to be as open to just having a camera around capturing spontaneous moments.
I'm going to ask you one last question. What do you think of how they the White House has been using video, and how they're, you know, the most recent things that they've been doing with Obama, you know, going before the House Republicans, the Senate Democrats. Today the OFA is doing a live chat where people have texted questions into him. I mean, obviously they're trying a variety of strategies.
Right. Well, I am excited that they have seen, you know, what happens when you capture a spontaneous moment, and you know, the power of that when people watch that and they know that, you know, something different happened, something that wasn't on script and something that wasn't coordinated and pre-planned happened. So I hope they're encouraged to take a lot more risk like that. And I sign the petition to demand question time, and I hope there's a lot more of that.
Great, great. Well, Kate, thank you so much. This has been a really, really interesting hour. As always, we really appreciate you making the time, and look forward to seeing you at the conference again this year. The 2 weeks from now, folks, we will be joined by Jeff Krigler and Clay Haynes from Catalyst, and the topic is Data is Power, How to Target Supporters and Win Votes, 2010. If you want to know everything about voter lists and voter targeting, join us in 2 weeks. Again, I want to thank our sponsors, AT&T and the Bivings Group, for their ongoing support for the PDF Network. And this call will be archived as a podcast and available online, so share it with your friends. Until then, we'll see you online. Thanks again, Kate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.